Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Mario Ritter, Anne Ball, and Christopher Jones Cruz. First, here is Brian Lynn.
Rights groups are calling on the United States to release details about its secretive drone attacks around the world. A recent U.S. drone strike in Pakistan led to the calls for more transparency. The leader of Afghanistan's Taliban was killed in that attack. In the past, U.S. drone aircraft have hit terrorist targets in Yemen and Somalia. Rita Simeon is with the group Human Rights First. She says the U.S. government should establish clear policies and provide real numbers on all its drone attacks.
Saying, just trust us, we have high standards, we're doing the best that we can, really isn't enough.
The administration of President Barack Obama has promised to provide this kind of information in a report soon. The report is expected to list the number of combatants and civilians killed in U.S. drone strikes since 2009. It will not have information from active battle areas like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. President Obama's spokesman, Josh Earnest, told reporters in March the report represents a big step forward for transparency.
We wouldn't even acknowledge publicly that these things were taking place. So the fact that we are now in a position on a regular, routinized basis to publish the results and to quantify the totals about the impact of these operations, I do think represents substantial progress in the direction of transparency.
But Human Rights First and other critics of the drone policy believe it is not enough to just list the number of deaths and injuries. They say administration officials should also explain how they collected the data and how they define terms used in the report. John Hanna worked as an advisor to two U.S. presidents, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. He says the drone program is not the best way to deal with terrorists.
The Obama administration has almost completely foregone an effort to capture and detain and get intelligence from these terrorists. Instead, it's unilaterally decided that it's going to be the judge, jury, and executioner.
Hanna does believe drone strikes can be effective in some areas. He noted countries such as Yemen and Pakistan, where the governments have not aggressively fought terrorists. Hanna also said drone attacks do reduce the number of civilian casualties compared to conventional military conflict. The answer, he said, is to create safeguards for accountability while balancing national security, transparency, and the rule of law.
And ensure that we're doing everything possible to find the right balance that ensures American security and yet at the same time ensures that we're not crossing that line into becoming a lawless nation.
I'm Brian Lynn.
Thank you. For more than 30 years, religious groups in many parts of the U.S. have provided refuge to immigrants who face possible expulsion from the country. Today, religious groups are treating non-criminal immigration law violators and their families differently. The effort to provide refuge for immigrants is called the Sanctuary Movement. It started more than 30 years ago at a time of civil and economic unrest in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. By the end of the 1980s, nearly 1 million refugees had fled north to the United States to seek asylum. Religious congregations sheltered refugees who would have been denied asylum. They opposed the efforts by the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service to deport those people. In 2014, something similar happened. Violence from the illegal drug trade and gangs, plus weak economic conditions in Central America, led to an increase of refugees and migrants, including children. Also, an estimated 4.5 million children born in the U.S. have parents who are undocumented. They lack the paperwork required to live as legal residents. The result has been a policy that has led to more than 350,000 removals each year. The term removal means being expelled from the country or denied entry at the border. In many of these cases, family members are separated. A leader of the Sanctuary Movement 30 years ago was Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona. Recently, the church has restarted its efforts to provide shelter and legal assistance to immigrants facing deportation. The Reverend Allison Harrington told VOA that a growing number of religious groups feel outraged and heartbroken over current U.S. policies. She said, "These congregations are opening their doors in hopes of keeping families and communities together." Harrington said individuals and politicians are fueling a growing anti-immigrant nativist movement. "You kind of have this rising of people who are people of faith who will be conscious to say, this is not who we believe we are as a people, as an American people," Harrington said. She added that she feels a moral imperative to help. Southside Presbyterian Church is near the Sonora Desert and the U.S. border with Mexico. Harrington said she often meets immigrants seeking assistance. The 1980s was a period Harrington calls a nightmare. She said 80 people slept on the church floor at times, with about 14,000 receiving shelter over a period of 10 years. However, the church now shelters one family at a time, rarely for more than a month. Harrington said she remembers the case of one family in 2014. A woman named Rosa, her husband and two sons, remained at Southside Presbyterian for a record 461 days before Rosa's case was resolved. "We had to get into high-level negotiations on that one," Harrington said. Judson Memorial Church in New York City provides sanctuary in more ways than one. It could be physical, it could be spiritual, it could be financial, it could be legal, the Reverend Donna Scopper said. But the most important term, she said, is accompaniment. We accompany about 200 people a month, and we train volunteers to go to ICE so they know their rights, she said. ICE is short for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the agency that deals with immigration issues. Scopper said that ICE employees are not the enemy, but she said what they do terrifies people, and she does not morally respect it. Miguel Angel Animas and his two U.S.-born daughters came to the Judson Memorial Church for help. His wife, the girl's mother, was recently deported to Mexico. Scopper says immigration, like other difficult issues, lacks a human face to inspire quick action or major reform. I can't let myself say that Americans don't know or that if they knew, they would do something, she said. They take care of dogs and cats. These people are not dogs and cats. However, Scopper still describes New York City as a very friendly city to immigrants. And during her time at the church, she has seen results, especially at the local level. The New Sanctuary Coalition of NYC is an alliance of congregations around New York City. In 2009, the coalition started an effort to support immigrants who were found guilty of minor offenses or whose cases were dismissed. The group sought to prevent ICE agents from questioning and detaining these immigrants at city jails. The church says that in 2011, the coalition's efforts resulted in then-New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg signing a bill that changed some of those practices. I'm Mario Ritter.
It might be hard to imagine, but scientists found a sponge the size of a minivan in deep waters near the Hawaiian Islands. The scientists said this sponge is the largest one ever found by researchers. A U.S. government research ship called the Okeanos Explorer found the record-setting sponge last year. A report on the discovery was published recently in the journal Marine Biodiversity. The ship was in the Pacific Ocean off the northwestern Hawaiian Islands when the researchers first saw the sponge. They were surprised to find it about 2 kilometers below the water's surface. Because the sponge is so large, the researchers said, it suggests that it is very, very old. They captured pictures of the rare organism with video taken by an underwater vehicle which was operated from the research ship. The sponge has a bluish-white color and looks a little like a huge brain. Christopher Kelly is a biologist at the Hawaii Undersea Research Lab. He helped with the research project. Here's this animal that has presumably never been encountered before, he told the Maui News, and it's enormous, and that kind of brings up a little intrigue for deep water and what else exists down there. The scientists said the sponge measured over 3.5 meters from one end to the other. They said it was from 1.5 to 2 meters wide. That would make it bigger than the largest sponge ever recorded. Scientists do not know how long sponges can live, but some of the large ones found in shallow water are thought to be over 2,300 years old. Some estimates say they could be thousands of years older. The largest portion of our planet lies in deep waters, the vast majority of which has never been explored, said Daniel Wagner. He is the lead scientist for the project with NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries. NOAA is short for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Wagner said that finding such a large sponge shows how much can be learned from studying deep and pristine environments, like the Papahanumuku Akea Marine National Monument in Hawaii. Sponges are similar to coral reefs because they give other sea life a habitat or place to live. They also filter seawater. They remove unwanted material that other sea creatures do not eat. The report said very large and old sponges provide key ecosystem services, such as filtering large amounts of seawater. According to the study, sponges also provide important homes for invertebrate and microbial species. Sponges are actually sea creatures, but sometimes people think they are plants. A website called Shape of Life says ancient sponges were the first animals on Earth, showing up about 2.5 billion years ago. Sponges are simple organisms. They come in many different shapes and sizes. They connect to rocks or other solid structures and get their food through seawater. The Papahanumuku Akea Marine National Monument was founded in 2006. Its website says the monument area is the largest contiguous, fully protected conservation area under the U.S. flag and one of the largest marine conservation areas in the world. It protects 362,073 square kilometers of land. That makes it bigger than every U.S. national park combined. The Okeanos Explorer made another discovery last February when it spotted a ghost-like octopus, believed to be a new species. The octopus was found in water over 4,000 meters deep off Hawaii's Neckler Island. Okeanos's remotely operated vehicle, Deep Discoverer, spotted the creature on a flat rock. According to NOAA, the appearance of this animal was unlike any published records and was the deepest observation ever for this type of cephalopod. I'm Ann Ball.
Robots are not new to the industrial world. But as technology keeps getting better, more robots are helping humans in the workplace. Some of the world's top robot innovators recently gathered at an expo in New York to show off their best machine workers. One person attending the Robo Universe Expo said robots are important because they can take over tasks humans do not want. The founder and CEO of a new company called Blue Workforce, Prem Yarna, said robots will always assist humans, not replace them. Robots have no conscience, no self-awareness, so they'll never be social. But they don't need to make a service for us, he said. Tom Malail, a technical manager at Universal Robots, agrees. Doing a repetitive, mundane task over and over again, I don't think that's a job any person should be doing, even for a day, he said. He added that a lot of companies with these kinds of jobs find it hard to keep workers. But luckily, robots do not mind being bored. They are also experts at repeating a task over and over again. Advances in technology have made robots very safe. Universal Robots demonstrated how one of its machines stopped moving after a human fell on it. Safety is especially important in workplaces such as car factories, where humans and robots work side by side. Designers at Transcend Robotics created a robot for very dangerous jobs, including mining and law enforcement. It has controllable cameras, climbs stairs, and travels over rough terrain. Chief Marketing Officer Alvin Wong said the machine aims to save lives. You can actually survey a hazardous environment before bringing a human into that area, he said. While some people fear robots will replace them, Wong said machines can actually help humans perform better. For example, police officers and soldiers consider the field of robotics to be their partner. Another use for modern robots is to help people who cannot walk. 5D robotics showed how its navigation technology can guide people in wheelchairs along pre-programmed paths. 5D's chief marketing officer, Phil Mann, said cars and airplanes can also use the same navigation technology. Mann and his colleagues believe Americans will soon have robot co-workers. But in most cases, he said workers won't even notice, except maybe to realize that their day goes by much faster. I'm Brian Lynn.
How to let go of the world and love all the things climate can't change is the latest movie from filmmaker and climate activist Josh Fox. The movie is the third film in a three-part series about climate change. In 2010, America's Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences nominated Fox's documentary Gasland for its highest award, an Oscar. Gasland explored fracking, the hotly debated process of removing natural gas from the ground. He examined the subject again in Gasland 2, the second film in his climate change series. Fox was in Washington, D.C. recently to present his third film. He was arrested during a protest against a new fuel pipeline. The arrest was evidence of his opposition to traditional fossil fuels and support of renewable energy. In the film, Fox says
pollution from fossil fuels must be reduced. Without limits, he says, there will be more extreme weather, like severe storms and dry weather, rising sea levels, and shortages of food and water.
It's going to change in some of the most difficult and dangerous ways that we can imagine. When you really encounter that head on, it causes an incredible crisis. I think you go deep into some kind of despair, and I think you ping-pong back and forth between that despair and denial.
Fox notes there are some things that climate cannot change.
And those are the things that are inside of us. Those are our value structure. And that is what the film starts to define. If we start to really emphasize building community, building human rights, building democracy, and the things that are inside, courage, love, generosity, innovation, creativity. And I think those are some of the hallmarks or the pillars of what we talk about when we talk about activism, when we talk about a response to climate change.
In the new film, Fox travels through a sunless forest in the Amazon with local activists to measure oil spills. He goes to a village in Ecuador to learn how people there stopped a pipeline from being built. He joins young people in Australia to stop barges from entering the port of Newcastle, the largest coal export center in the world.
We are the Burundi! We are fighting! We are not joining! We are fighting! We are not joining! We are fighting!
Before I say anything else about this sequence, you should probably know that the downside of what we were about to do was, this is a short list. Drowning, arrest, run over by boats, all kinds of sharks, jellyfish, getting punched, sea creatures, drifting away in currents out into the Pacific Ocean, cultural disrespect, big waves. Well, you get the idea.
The port at Newcastle was forced to close for just one day. But Fox says that was a major victory.
I think that protest was incredibly effective, but what it also did was it was a win internally for those folks. And for all of us, that we can celebrate and that we realize resilience is one of the most important things going forward, and these people exhibit so much resilience.
Also in the film, Fox talks to Ella Zhao, an energy expert with the U.S. Department of Energy. She works in China. She met him at the Great Wall to explain the importance of what she calls moral imagination.
I think the moral imagination forces us to get out of our box of thinking about, for instance, what is being successful. The moral imagination allows us to think outside of this box, having a moral value about what you want as a person, as an individual, what you want out of your own humanity. What do you want to do for the world, for yourself?
If there was any idea that could rocket you off into the stratosphere, this was it. The moral imagination wrote the Bill of Rights, came up with the idea of democracy.
One, two, three, solution!
Fox is visiting 100 cities with his new film to try to bring attention to the efforts being made to fight climate change. His film will be shown on the television cable channel HBO soon. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.